Welcome home, friends. I'm Tanya Long, and this is Reset, where purpose meets possibility. Each week, we share conversations with thought leaders, innovators, and the dreamers and doers who are reshaping the future of work, technology, longevity, and purpose. Whether you are navigating AI's impact, reimagining your career, or searching for deeper meaning, you're in the right place. So settle in, open your mind, and let's explore what happens when purpose meets possibility. Welcome to Reset with Tanya, and I welcome Igor. Thank you. So you're going to learn in just a moment. Kresnit is Igor's family name. He's the founder and CEO of Tech and Web and IdealData.io. So that should tell you this man has tons of history in the tech environment, and he helps B2B manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors simplify complexity and scale faster. Now, that just means he makes everything better that he touches, and we will learn what that looks like in a few minutes. He brings some fascinating perspectives. We are all about resets on this show, pivots, transitions, and resets. And Igor has had several. You're going to learn that he moved to the States when he was 17, finished his last year of high school here, has been here then for 20-ish years. We won't say how long, but he's been here for 20-ish years, had a family here, and then relocated. He boomeranged because he went from the Bay Area to Austin, Texas, was there 15, 16 years.
And 17.
17 years. Yeah. You're aging yourself.
Yeah, I know. It's okay.
And then moved.
I think at one point you kind of give up on aging yourself and just say, look,
this is what
you
got to own it.
That's right.
I met you guys when I met your wife first at a networking event. And then we became friends, and then you and she started showing up in all the watering holes that I haunt. And it's been wonderful to watch you in just a few short months work toward finding your way in your community here. So we are thrilled to have you, and I'm excited to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you, Tanya. Thank you for having me here, and thank you for sharing your audience with me. Excited about this conversation.
It's all wonderful. So we've got 55 more minutes to unpack the beginning of Igor Kresnit. I put an F on it instead of an H. But tell us a little bit about how you arrived and what your priorities are.
Okay, so born and raised in Russia, in a small city called Dubna. And when we departed, I think that city was about 60,000 people, so very small town. Spent my youth there. My dad is the nuclear scientist. He worked at the Junior Institute of Nuclear Research. Oh, thank you. And he was, I kind of want to say this, I mean this in the nicest way possible. He's a workaholic. He loves doing what he does.
He's found his passion.
And I think I inherited that gene from him, because I see that in myself, and my wife, Anna, tells me about it quite often, that I tend to spend a lot of time at work or working on the new ideas and working on the business, helping people, etc. But going back to Russia, so went to high school there, and we decided, so my dad got a job offer to come work for SLAC, Stanford Linear Accelerator Collider, I think stands for.
Not the messenger application.
Not the messenger application. So he got a contractor gig to come work here in California, and he decided to take all of us with him because the contract was for 3 years.
Wow.
And I'm going to age myself with this one. So in 1997, in April, that's when we packed everything, sold whatever we didn't need to bring with us, hopped on a plane, and it was four of us. It was my mom, my dad, my younger sister, and me. And we made a trip over to California with a stop in New York or overlay in New York. And when we got to California, man, I feel like I can talk about this for a very long time. So, having lived in Russia, I experienced two interesting kind of financial times, so to speak, where the first time when people had a lot of money, but they didn't have, there was no products on shelves. And there was a flip of that where people didn't have money, but there was abundance of products on shelves. And so it was kind of like experiencing both of those spectrums. And then when we came to the United States, I think it was like within the first or second day, my dad asked us to go to the store and get some orange juice and some vegetables or fruits and stuff like that. And we came, I don't know if it was Safeway or something similar. And there was just there were so many different items on shelves, gazillion of different milk types, of different like orange juices. Like we were—
You had choice.
Too much choice.
Yeah.
Too much choice. That kind of engraved into my memory when we came to the United States, it was just too much choice. And it was like, what do we buy? What do we buy? But anyways, so we made that trip over to the United States, and that's where my journey in the United States has begun.
I love it. So I think about, you have two children, not quite teenagers.
Yes, 6 and 10,
and
boy
and
a girl.
And I think about you moving them from Austin. And then I think about your mom and dad making a huge choice to move you when you were a little older, but still definitely their child and at home and in school with a network and a community. Did that have any bearing on how you moved? Your children were born in Austin with the age that they are.
Yep.
Did you think back to how it felt for you when you were uprooted, right, from your friends and your routines? I think kids are a lot more resilient than sometimes we give them credit for. But did you reflect on that when you made the choice to come back to the Bay Area?
Great question. And thinking back, that transition from Russia to the United States was not a simple transition for me because language is different, schools
absolutely.
Are different, education system is different. We're leaving all our friends and family in the other country.
And you had 5 brands of orange juice to choose from.
Yes,
right.
That's true. The biggest thing that I remember, and I'm still like fascinated by it. But when we decided to come back to the Bay Area, I didn't think back to the time when I came to Russia and how it was for me. However, my wife and I, we did talk about when is the right time to move, whether it's at the end of the school year or should we just do it right away in the middle school year. And I remember her sharing, and man, this is kind of a little bit blurry for me. So remember hearing an advice from somebody that said, look, if you wait until the end of the school year, it might be more difficult for your kids to adjust to the new environment because everyone goes away for summer. And when they come back, they all want to see their old friends that they haven't seen for like 2-3 months. And they would be spending time with them instead of the new kid. And the best time to move was middle of the year, because when you do move, you're the only new kid in the class and you get the most attention. Mm-hmm. And that resonated with us a lot. And we made a decision to move during the kind of mid of the year to make sure we position our kids, kind of blend it into the environment and get up to speed very quickly and find friends quickly.
I think that was really wise. That would not have been my intuition, but now that you state it, it completely makes sense. And in my talks with Anna, she has reflected that she has seen your kids grow so much. Just in the short time, the 3 or 4 months that you guys have been here, and getting them actively involved and into, we talked about soccer before we started this show. So your
strategy was successful. And I'm thinking back, maybe a few weeks back, I asked Anna a question, how is she feeling and how are our kids feeling from her perspective? Now that we've been here for several or a few months. And she said that she is already used to being in Bay Area. She loves being here. She loves nature. She loves going outside on nature walks and things like that. She settled in and the kids seem to be loving school. Mm-hmm. And I also asked Misha if he misses Texas or any of his friends. And not as much. He does miss two of his buddies that he developed a very close relationship with last year. He misses them. But outside of that, he found new friends here in California, and he's spending a lot of his time after school. He's now starting to play with some of the kids there. Some of his friends in his class are going to the same soccer program. So he's loving it. And our daughter's also loving outside.
Good. Good. So they're thriving. And I see Anna thriving. So back to you. I think about that transition from Russia to here and all that you went through. And now you we'll talk about some of your pivots in business. But how did that early life experience of coming from Russia to here shape how you look at business and especially technology? Because you and I experience technology as a very global conversation. It's not limited to a specific geography because the people we work with are everywhere on the planet. So how did moving from Russia and then and recalibrating yourself when you were 17, how did that impact how you look at the business world now?
There's, and I want to blend in two things. So transitioning from another culture to the United States culture, and also something that I started to do while I was going to high school in Russia, I think helped me create this mindset that helped me on my entrepreneurial path. So with, which one do I start with? Maybe transition to a new culture. So when you're transitioning to a new culture, I've mentioned that, you know, language is very different, how people think are different, and many, many people who came from a different country who speak a different language, I think this will resonate with them because the way you learn a language, you learn the words, you know what you want to say, but you think about, I thought in Russian what I wanted to say, then translated it in my head and said it, and when somebody responded back, I had to translate it back into Russian, all of that. So that transition was quite interesting, and I've learned to, now I like even dream and think in English now, given so much time has passed, but being able to pay attention and really listen to people when they talk to you or communicate what they want to say, I think that was a very good skill that I've learned early on. Even, I don't want to skip through the school and high school ages, obviously you have to listen to your teachers, but I think when I came into the United States, I had to put much, much more effort into listening, understanding, and learning from that perspective.
What a nice byproduct.
It is.
A struggle, right? Just, an, if you will, an intellectual struggle to learn a new language and a new culture. But the fact that it made you a more focused listener to understand what content is coming to you would have implications way beyond the transition event.
Of course. And it also teaches you patience, too, because you
Yes. I wasn't going to call you patient. Although I do think you present as very patient, but I wasn't going to call you patient. I wasn't going to give you that rope for yourself.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, my kind of tech career started from, I mentioned earlier that my dad was spending a lot of his time at work in Russia. And he always was looking for opportunities to go to work. And I remember my mom was telling him, like, you can only go to work if you take kids with you. And he used that as an opportunity.
Went to work with your dad.
There's a caveat to that. So yes, I did. And
don't worry, Russia's not listening.
No. And when he took me first. My sister, I think, was too young at that stage when I went to my dad's work first. And he had to do, I can't even describe or explain what he did, but it was something with like accelerators and et cetera. So he said, look, like, here's a computer. You play with this computer while I go do my stuff.
And he gave you a toy.
A toy, right.
Yes.
And this is going to really age me too. So back then, imagine like this huge box that sits on the desk, and it had 2 5.25-inch floppy disks.
Oh, yes.
One of them was the operating system. The other one had like video games, basic video games. And I think back then, hopefully I'm not going to make this up, but I feel like the RAM for the computer was like 8 KB or 16 KB.
Oh, yeah.
And you
My first computer was a VIC-20. Do you know what a VIC-20 is?
Don't.
The Commodore?
Commodore, I've heard of
Commodore VIC-20, and that would have been about 82 or 84 when I got that. I read about that in my book. I've forgotten which year it was, but the age I was, it was either 82 or 84. Man. Yeah, I don't know how we
Yeah, so
you couldn't even open an email now on those computers.
Right, it was just command prompt. Yeah. You type stuff in
Absolutely.
There, right? Like start games. And that's what mm-hmm. I did. My first introduction to computers was playing those like kind of basic video games. I started to like computers because they were fun.
Yeah.
And as I grew, as I transitioned, I remember a time when my dad came to our house from work and he said, I have a friend who has built a web page that anybody with internet
Ooh.
Access can see.
Ooh.
Like, oh my God, what is that? Show me. And he opened up our browser, punched in the URL, and this website came
yep.
up. It was just super boring text, loud colors and things like that. So I was like, oh, that's cool. In my head, to me, that was the trigger where I started asking myself questions. How can I do this? How can I learn? Mm-hmm. Back then, I didn't have access to any books.
Yeah.
There's no YouTube videos on mm-hmm. how to do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I just opened up that page, View Source, and the rudimentary path, and just
But you were pretty deep. You were
yeah.
deep into the structure for
yes.
HTML.
HTML.
Back then.
Yes.
Yeah, back then it was probably not.
Yeah, so I mean, I just had to figure out, like, what does this tag
yeah.
do? Are there any other tags? And just mm-hmm. through trial, and that's what I want to highlight
mm-hmm.
here, is through trial and error, I kind of reversed engineered on how to do this stuff.
Yeah, you learned to think.
Yes, and I think that was the kind of the springboard for me into my career where anything that was fascinating to me, mm-hmm. exciting to me, I went in deep and I was trying to figure it out. Again, later on,
Perfect.
It was like watching videos, reading books, mm-hmm. experimenting with things, not worried about failing. I'm going to take a sidestep here. So Thomas Edison, he had a nice quote.
Oh, yeah. Know the one.
I have not failed. I found 10,000 ways of things that don't work.
That takes patience, too.
Exactly.
You mentioned patience earlier. It does. I don't think people have the same tolerance these days for iterating. People want instant success and results.
Yes. And to now segue back into the founder entrepreneurial
yeah.
world, I think that is what sets successful entrepreneurs and founders apart is the ability to, you stumble, you fall, you hurt yourself
mm-hmm.
on this journey. Being able to quickly get up and continue to walk and even maybe run, have patience, and where other people give up, you don't, and you continue
yep.
to push forward.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my motto is, and
yeah.
that's what I live
yeah.
by.
I love it. I love it. I am going to grab a point that you've made and do a quick public service announcement
sure.
because you learning what you did when you were in your early teens by following your dad to the office and him having to occupy you. Kids today, it's about to be summer break. And I know all the parents out there are looking for how am I going to schedule my kids so they're learning during the summer and they're having fun. And we have an opportunity this summer here at the radio station. We are doing radio camp starting in June, and kids age 13 to 17 can be in camp and learn how to do their own radio station, learn how to do their own podcast. So I think that is a very cool camp. I did not have those kinds of camps when I was growing up.
It's
so
cool.
It starts in June. Go to kpcr.org online on that internet that Igor was talking about and get more details. But I think that would be a great camp to send a kid to learn the mechanical skills of operating this mixer board. A lot of kids do want to build their own podcast these days, and there's a lot of moving parts to that. So I think it's a great camp for kids to sign up for the summer.
Are there any age restrictions on that one?
13 to 17 is our target audience.
Okay.
So yeah, there's got to be some level of decision-making skills and intellectual capability, I think, with some of the tools and applications we use. Mm-hmm. 13 is the youngest at this point. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, fun. So that was a good segue for me to do a public service announcement for the KPCR radio camp. Let's bring you into adulthood.
Okay.
You've done really well hanging in there with the impact of your teen years. But if we look at your adulthood, you did all the normal transitioning things into adulthood, but then you ran fairly large digital transformations at companies like Express Scripts, I think General Motors. So for you, what prompted your reset? Because you've talked a couple of times already about entrepreneurship. You had some big corporate experience, and then you reset back to entrepreneurship. What triggered that for you?
Oh, great question.
Yes.
So as my career kind of started from high school, I feel like, when I first started to build websites.
Nothing wrong with that.
And I always had that drive to go build things. And throughout my early journey, through end of high school here, I went to Woodside High School.
Okay, shout out to Woodside.
Then spent some time in a Foothill College, community college. And from there, I feel like, well, maybe this is the wrong way to say it, but I got sucked into the into the world of entrepreneurship, because a friend of mine and I, we decided that, how about we, like, and I think it was around the dot-com boom time frame, we were like, let's build our own digital agency where we do design and web development. I was taking computer science, or focusing on computer science, when I went to Foothill College. And a friend of mine also was expressing interest in computer science, and he was more on kind of technical sales side of things back then. So we're like, let's do this together. And that was the first start of my true entrepreneurial journey. Long story short, there was a time when we couldn't really crack the nut on sales and marketing, because, like, we needed to build our pipeline. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, family started to occur, girlfriends and all of that. We basically said, look, like, maybe this is not the right time. And at that point, I said, let me maybe go get a part-time corporate gig or something like that, just to make sure that financially I'm able to grow and things like that. And that decision sucked me into the corporate world. Mm-hmm. So I put my kind of entrepreneur idea on the side for the digital agency. I spent many years in the corporate world, but throughout that corporate journey, I was always excited when I thought of different ideas on different products that I wanted to create and bring to market. And those typically came from, like, me experiencing some gap, which I couldn't figure out how to do. So a couple of kind of my early failed startups are, one was the B-List, the business listing, which is now kind of like Yelp equivalent. So it was early in that. Yeah. I built that platform. I was even advertising it on Craigslist, and at one point got an email from Craig at Craigslist saying, hey, you shouldn't be advertising this stuff on my platform. I got in trouble.
Oh, I think that's a great story. So you got a message from the Craig.
Well, I don't know if it was him. I'm assuming it was. Yes.
They were a pretty rogue little group. I think it probably was him.
Maybe. Yeah. So anyways, it was that. And after that, it was a platform that I wanted to create, which is Find What To Do. It's basically, like, in the evenings, like, where do you go and hang out? Mm-hmm. Like, the event websites and things like that. And the last one was the Adroit Nation, which was kind of social tech network for tech community. Because at that point, when you met with people, you didn't know what their skills were. Yep. So my idea was, okay, let's bridge that gap. But in all of those kind of failed startups, the big problem that I came across with, because I didn't possess any marketing knowledge or experience, I didn't have anybody within my network who could help me with those things. And even sales, after the platform is done, I was like one of those entrepreneurs who are like, let's build it and then customers will come. Oh my God, that was difficult realization when, the product is ready, and then go to market is even more important.
Wouldn't you say that's still the biggest challenge?
In
the founders that we work with, the entrepreneurs that we help advise,
of course,
they want to build. And it's hard, even for myself, when I've done my own things, I want to build because it feels good. You can get that done, what you're trying to create. And it's so the unknown, and the rejection factor is 20 times higher.
It is. So those hard lessons, and I know I'm deviating off of the original question, but
it's fine.
What I've learned is, and the way that I'm starting to, starting is the wrong word to use here, doing things now is testing the market first, doing pre-sales, ensure there's demand, and you gotta create all of that even before you start building prototypes. Like, a lot of the products now can be started with just a conversation saying, look, I'm building this awesome feature. I think it's awesome. would it be beneficial to you, mm-hmm, Tanya? And then you say, yeah, I could care less. That could be one answer
that
you
get. Saved me
a lot of time. Saved me a lot of time. Or it could be, look, I love this idea. Yes, I would totally use this product when you build it. And that to me is step number one of multiple steps on that journey, because then you interview your close friends, see what's the demand, average it out. Mm-hmm. To jump a little bit ahead of myself here, you can even these days do paid Facebook advertising, social media advertisement to test the idea further, see how much demand there is. And from there, the next big question, which even more founders typically leave until the very end, is how do I make money off of this? If I need to feed my family, I need to eat, I need a roof above my head. So the question of money, based on what I've seen, comes towards the tail end, and it should be one of the first questions that you
How do you monetize this before you build it?
Right. And a good way to do this, and I shared an article on LinkedIn in my weekly newsletter, was how to do this, right? So you first go to your 10 close friends and say, all right, people who said you love the idea, would use it. You say, what's it worth to you? How much is this problem going to save you time, and how much are you willing to pay for? Mm-hmm. And I've done this several times with some of my friends, and you get a range of numbers, right? Yeah. Some people say, oh, I only use it if it's free, or only it's only worth like $2 for me, or $5 or $15. So now that you're starting to aggregate that those digits and numbers together, and you figure out what should the price of this product be, right? Based on the value that you're providing.
What's the edges. Tolerance?
And from there, you ask the next question saying, all right, so if you really want this product, let's say it's available tomorrow, can I get your credit card for this?
Now you sound like a swindler.
Yeah.
I was going to reflect that for people who don't consider themselves salespeople, what you just described feels a lot more natural and easy. Hey, I'm building this. I'm in the middle of doing this. What would you think about this? What would you pay for this? Is to me, for whatever reason, just a lot simpler than saying, hey, I've got the best blue pen ever. You want to buy it?
That's horrible. I'm just doing it for effect.
But still, even when you've softened your entry into the conversation, you're asking somebody to buy something, and a lot of people are very reluctant to do that. And
sure.
I think if you do it as you're collecting feedback, then you have hopefully a whole list of people to go back to say, hey, that thing I was talking about 3 months ago, I've got that ready. Do you want to try this?
I think this is something that I want to unfold or peel the onion on this one, because I've been in the situations where I got positive response saying, yes, I would use this product, how much I'm going to pay you. Whenever it's ready, just build it. I went and I built it, and then more than half of those people say, don't need it anymore. And that's the ugly truth that you stumble upon very frequently. And to me, how to do the pre-sale, it's all about how you phrase it. How do you position it? It doesn't have to be like, buy it right now, but look, I'm looking to raise some of these funds to invest into this platform, and any contribution right now, even like $2 investment right now, will help me, because it's money towards that solution which you said you need. So again, like this, what I just came up with, it may not be perfect, but that's where I would try to position it to and say, who is early enough can help you at least generate some cash to help you continue to invest that cash into finishing and building that product? Because how much money you collect from those individuals that want that solution, it really doesn't matter, because it takes a big effort, just like you said, for somebody to take their credit card or write a check, small check. And that's where you get the true qualification of your service or a product. If somebody is willing to do that, then there's a much higher likelihood for them to purchase your product compared to, I'll buy it when it's ready.
Yeah.
I've heard that a dozen times.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I'm going to do a quick station ID at the bottom of the hour. So we are listening and I usually do a weather report, and it is a gorgeous, bright, sunny day with beautiful blue skies here in Los Gatos as we broadcast live from the studio of KPCR LP 92.9 FM. And we're also going out over sister station KMRT LP, and that's 101.9 FM out of Santa Cruz. So we appreciate all of our listeners being here for the conversation of Reset with Tanya, here with Igor Krasnyak. Did I get closer?
Yes.
Good. And if I just do it 100 more times, I should have it. Right.
Good.
Awesome. Good. Awesome. You were just giving very wise advice about qualifying interest, even in the smallest, $2. And I know it's just, we're just giving an example. But I do think you're right to commit people, because there is a lot of people want to support you. People want to tell you your idea is good. Their intentions are good, but you don't need good intentions when you're about to spend a lot of time creating and money building something. You want to know, can I monetize this? So I think the solution you just offered is very helpful. Do you have any interesting stories from when you've done that and it's been, and it was a real game changer for what you were developing?
It's a whole mind shift, because I did not think this way. And I am still kind of engraving that into my neurology to make sure it's like natural and consistent. And it's tough. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it all starts with practice. And as long as you practice and practice those ideas, I think you will be far better positioned to grow your business or grow your idea beyond just an idea and hype. Verbal hype, so to speak. Even if you do a prototype, but then it's like I'm reflecting back on my early days of those find what to do and other things. Like, okay, you build a product. Mm-hmm. There is a chance you could get lucky and demand will be there. Mm-hmm. People in your network could help you grow it. But, you know, it's a lot easier when you put the necessary kind of fundamental pillars into play and build that foundation early on.
You just mentioned network, and I'm wondering, you've had these transitions that we've been talking about more broadly, but how important is your network when you are starting a new journey or a new venture? Not just the move you've just made, but when you're building something, when you're an entrepreneur creating a company, what's your advice for tapping into those networks and getting useful responses, not just supportive ones?
Oh man, there's a short answer and a long answer, of course, but network is extremely important. Mm-hmm. It's a short answer. The long answer is, having walked that entrepreneurial path, there is time for everything. There's time where all you need is just laser focus, building, experimenting with things and just saying, is this possible thinking? And if so, which tools do I need to use to do this? If you're successful on that path and you're able to figure things out on your own, great. That's the path you don't need to, in my personal opinion, if I know how to, I don't know, peel a potato, I'm not going to go ask, after I've done it, I don't know, I'm not going to go ask somebody else on how to do it. To me, that's inefficiency from my perspective. But when you are running into a wall and you see yourself spending a lot of time trying to get the answer to your question, and given where all the social media and YouTubes are, there's a high chance that you can probably find on how to do something online, those videos, or at least get a general idea. And I'm going to dive super technical here. And even like complex integrations and coding, you can throw documentation into ChatGPT and ask a question and see if it can help you accelerate your journey from start to finish. But there are times where your network comes into play and helps you break down those walls that you're unable to break down on your own using technology or just based on your knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the kind of one of the big misconceptions that I see is it's not just who you know and whether or not that individual can help you solve the problem, but it's who they know. It's like multi-level deep, right? And it's just being able to, your network in the ideal stage, mm-hmm. be a network where you are able to connect through maybe one or multiple individuals to the right person and help you on the journey to take that one inch forward step.
Yeah, let's have this conversation. We are in an environment where there is a lot of connecting. And I've experienced a lot of people announcing to me, I'm a super connector. Because it's a thing here. We do invest a lot of our time. But to the point that you just made, it is so important. You can't just brand yourself a super connector. You, and for you people who are listening, yeah, I'm talking to you. We were talking about one of my favorite super connectors that you met with earlier this morning. But I just really try to help people understand it's the quality of the connections that you make over the quantity. So many people are chasing a number. They want 20,000 LinkedIn connections, and they're chasing the wrong things. And it can be very expensive from a time perspective for them, as well as for the people that they hook into conversations that aren't relevant, conversations that don't appear to have a strong purpose for the connection.
And I want to kind of piggyback off of that,
please.
And echo saying that when you're a super connector, it's not just, look, here's the person in my Rolodex, here's an intro, you might find something in common. It goes much deeper, and you touched on that, because it's, as a connector, you have to understand how that connection, let's say person A, and you think person B might be a good connection to each other, but knowing exactly how and asking from their perspective, saying, for person A, what's their with them? What's in it for me?
Yes.
And for person A and B, what's in it for me? Is there mutual value? Mm-hmm. And if there's mutual value, then obviously connect them. But it happens more than you probably think, or you've probably seen this, but it's just, look, I just met this person here. You guys talk. And it's like, what do I talk about?
I've started refusing those. I have a little canned LinkedIn thing that I send now that seems very personal. But when I meet someone at an event and 2 days later they ask me to introduce, and I meet them, I shake their hand, I connect on LinkedIn. 2 days later they want me to introduce them to someone way above their pay grade that happens to be in my network. And I try to explain, I try to coach them through a LinkedIn message to say, my curated network came at a price, and I don't just introduce anyone into those higher levels unless they're ready to have those conversations. You get this a lot out of less experienced people who are just going to the top of the stack to meet a CEO of a company, and it's, no, you're in an early stage in your career. If you want to go to company X, let's figure out how to get you introduced, but I can't lead that connection point for you because I really don't know anything about your work.
And maybe a different way to kind of look at it too is when you make an introduction, your reputation is on the line.
100%.
And if you make a wrong introduction, then that person, you're losing that person out of your network. Every introduction that you make, it's got to be genuine.
And the people I introduce to people take it seriously because I'm not constantly overfeeding or oversubscribing to that relationship with non-quality. And it's not non-quality, it's just a mismatch of skills and needs. You were talking about, does person A need person B? Does person B benefit? You know, is there some mutual exchange of value? So it's up to us to help mentor people who are coming into these environments and very much are ambitious and want to do big things. But you don't start at the top to do those things typically.
Yes. And thinking back, from my perspective, it's all about, I'm a giver.
Yeah.
I'm not a taker. I know a lot of takers, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And even if I want to meet somebody who is above my pay grade, I am instantly thinking, like, what is the value that I provide to them
before
I ask for anything back? Mm-hmm. And maybe that value is so small that I need to provide multiple touch points, multiple values to them before I can feel comfortable asking for something in return. So I believe that if you have that mindset going into a networking event or whatever the situation is, just be a giver.
Be a giver. I'm writing that one down. That I think we could write a book on Be a Giver. What do you think? You want to co-author it? Be
a giver. Oh, my God.
Giver.
I'm a horrible author. Maybe with help of ChatGPT, maybe a few ideas. But
I think you would do just fine. So this topic, there are other topics. If people that are listening, if they knew you on LinkedIn, they would know you like I know you as someone who, there's a lot of meat on the bone. You're not just lounging in your backyard with the dog and the soccer ball and saying, oh, It's a beautiful day in Los Gatos. You're not a social poster. You are.
I am not.
Your every post is like a micro MBA lesson.
And, oh, man, want to touch on that, too. And this is something recent that I started to do, because with the fast-moving pace of AI and everything like that, need for a brand, a personal brand, is becoming more and more important. I want to call myself like I am an introvert by nature, because in order for me to recharge, I want to be on my own with my own thoughts and stuff like that. And when I go to events, I think the other, I'm a Gemini, so the other twin kind of kicks in and saying, all right.
So your birthday's coming up.
My birthday's coming up.
Because I'm a Taurus. I'm right before you.
All right.
Okay.
Look, my train of thought, where I was going with this.
I apologize. I did that. My fault. We were talking about you evolving to this brand and person. I want to say personality, but it's a brand.
Yes.
And on social media, you are, I don't want to call it rigid, but you are... You're declarative. You are guiding people on business principles and practices. It's a wealth of information you're sharing.
Yes, and I remember where I left off. I'm an introvert, so me being spending time on social media, this is new to me. This is, I feel like it's a little bit scary to some degree, but I believe that it needs to be done, and you just have to be consistent. There was a lot of lessons learned and things that I, like mental mind block that I had to overcome to get to where I'm at today.
Yeah.
But I am happy that what I do today on social media starting to become a little bit more natural. And it just, it's a flow. It's becoming a flow. I love it. And where I was going with all of this is at the end of the day, if I rewind back how product knowledge or sales or education was done, like, you know, thinking back, it was a lot of cold calling, go door to door, asking, do you need a new refrigerator or a new roof or whatever it is. So I feel like with the world of AI, there's an abundance of information available on social media. And cold calling for many industries no longer works as well as it used to be. Emails, I have my one of my emails that I never check because it's just a spam box of trash that, like,
that's my Yahoo
I don't care
account.
About. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we all have one of those.
So
to me, it's how do you stand out? How do you generate that demand, or how do you continue to educate? And to me, it's all about sharing what I've learned, sharing the mistakes that I've made on my journey, and sharing how I solved those or overcame some of those challenges with the world. And I'm not looking for anything back, but what kind of naturally starting to happen is people who follow and read that content, they do reach out when they're ready.
They engage. At least I see them engage in comments. You probably see even more on private direct messages.
Yes.
And, yeah, that's
and
wonderful.
It's fascinating because at that point, you no longer need to figure out when do I need to send that marketing or sales material to person A. You know when they're ready, and they're reaching out to you when they're ready. And to me, that's a whole new concept. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you are doing well. Let me do a quick station identifier for KPCR LP 92.9. We are a community radio station. So that means we are a nonprofit radio station. We champion makers, creators, doers, and dreamers. Very artistic. I don't consider myself artistic. We're all more creative, though, today, I think, than we were 5 years ago. But this station has always been focused on enabling. The sound of Pirate Cat Radio is a very eclectic mix of artists and creators who share with the local community. And, of course, you can also find us online from anywhere at kpcr.org. So it's a pleasure to be here and be part of this radio family. It has been a fun part of my journey.
Woot woot.
Woot woot woot. Thank you. Woot woot. Nice. I'll bring an air horn next time. We were talking about that before we started.
Yeah. How we're doing on time.
Yeah. We
have a hard stop.
We do.
Okay.
We do. And about 10 more minutes. So I'm just trying to narrow down because we've talked about so many things. With your, one thing I did want to ask though, what pivoted you toward your social media presence? What drove you to focus on such specific topics where you are actually, you are coaching the masses with every email, and not every email, every post you put out. What inspired you to do that or motivated you to do that so that other people can understand? Because I think a lot of people, there's a lot of lurkers, a lot of people who read our stuff who never, we never know they're out there until we see them in an event and they say, I'm a huge fan. And it's, who are you? Because, yeah, they've just not engaged.
I have some of those.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
It is, isn't it?
I had, in the last 2 weeks, I had two people who mentioned to me saying, like, I love your content.
Exactly.
But they left zero likes, zero comments. I'm like, right. Okay.
But for me, that's just how our heart is engaged with what we're doing, too. One of my best stories on that front. Mm-hmm. Is I had 11:30 at night one night, I got a message on LinkedIn from a young woman in Africa. She was in Nigeria or Ghana, I've forgotten. But she and all her little friends, they worked at the equivalent of a Comcast. It was some kind of cable broadcasting call center. And they all read my columns and they read the comments in my columns. At the time, I was a member of Chief and we were really supportive of, and I had this little family, this sisterhood of, and we would banter about everything, no matter what the post was about. And these young women were reading our posts as, this is how we are going to seek relationships as we grow in our careers. And we look to you because we don't have female mentorship here in Nigeria. And we watch you and your friends and how you interact. And I said, let me... Oh, I cried. It was so sweet. And the thing I helped her understand, I said, because she asked if she could connect with me. It was one of those where, and the thing that I shared with her is, most of these women I've never met in person. They live across the country. We're in COVID right now. And I know them through our interactions online, which should tell you, you may be sitting in Nigeria, but you can have a community of support around you from all over the world. Yeah. Just start. And it was such a beautiful moment. And I realized when I'm not getting the engagement that I want off of a really meaningful post, somebody out there is seeing that and benefiting from it.
That's fascinating because I tend to, from time to time, think the same way. Mm-hmm. My God, I thought I just posted this amazing piece of content and like very little engagement.
And I got 10 likes.
Right. But I keep reminding myself, and this is something I want to give shout out to a friend of mine in Austin, Sean Dodd. He's the CEO of a social media marketing agency. Mm-hmm. He's the one who first challenged myself and a few other business owners to do the social media challenge. That's where it all came from.
I love it.
And he invested his time to educate us every week about what works on every platform, what you mm-hmm. should do, what you should not do. He basically said, just be consistent. And you have to publish every day and yep. make sure that whatever you publish is genuine and it's you. You're mm-hmm. not like fabricating something mm-hmm. and just stay consistent and don't worry about the engagement, comments, or your community for at least a year. And I want to say with AI and oversaturation of content, it might be maybe a couple of years or maybe it depends, right?
Wow.
On what you're publishing, but just don't worry because when you're providing value to your community, the community will find you. And it takes time.
Wow. We are not patient enough for that.
We're not patient enough.
No, so, because, gosh, I want that. I want that, like, dopamine hit of people recognizing the value of my work.
It will happen.
Yeah.
And I think, who was it? I think it was Gary Vaynerchuk who said,
yeah.
Look, so he said, if you're not getting engagement at all, then you need to look, maybe your content sucks. But at the end of the day, I think his statement about that was like, look, if you've already put in a lot of time and you don't see any, the needle is just not moving, mm-hmm. it's probably your content. But a big chunk of content that I see, it's all like, here's what I do. Here's what it's all about mm-hmm. me. It's all about me. It's not about the audience. It's not about the community. And if you're publishing content about your community, about, you know, and helping individuals, businesses, mm-hmm. et cetera, then that community will find you because you're a giver. If you're a taker, probably at mm-hmm. least I don't engage with content and
yeah.
That's like taker content.
Okay. Gary Vee is a different conversation for us for another time. He has just had a remarkable transformation as far as I'm concerned with his online presence. That's the seed for you for a later conversation. He has hugely pivoted, in my opinion, in the last 4 or 5 years. And he's in a, for those of you who don't know, Gary Vee, and he has had his hands in everything. Wine production. Definitely, I put him on the stage as a motivational speaker. But I've seen a real, like, heart shift in him in the last, I would say, 3 or 4 years. And it's been pretty remarkable.
Let's talk about it.
I have to bring you back, and we'll have a Gary Vee support episode. So as we start to wind down our time, the final question I want to ask for you, the final formal question, is around what for the future. I think you have a pretty amazing crystal ball. So because you're on the cutting edge of a lot of this, and you're doing things that are outside your comfort zone. So you see a lot. So what do you think is the next big reset that you see coming for businesses and entrepreneurs? And in general, how should people prepare so they can optimize that?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. We only have a few minutes left. Here are my thoughts on that topic. I believe that with the world of AI, business owners or founders are now able to do more on their own before they need to think about bringing in somebody else, like a business partner, mm-hmm. you know, making a first hire, etc. And it's fascinating to watch that tools these days, there's tools that it's like stitch AI together, and AI can now do a lot more, not just a repetitive single task, but it's a sequence of tasks. I want to see how that evolves and how that changes everything. But tying it back to the business ownerships and founders, don't rush to hire somebody. And I first would look at whatever you do, whatever you're trying to offload off of your plate, can AI do that job well with quality? Obviously important, it's a given. And if so, continue to build it. I think before AI, many companies are able to grow from 0 to 7 figures just by having a single employee at a company. From there, I think with the AI, that number will change. It's probably going to go to 8 and 9 figures, depending on what your business is. So don't look to grow by adding more people, but look at the opportunity to optimize and streamline your businesses to build a very solid foundation for you to be able to grow further, more and further, right? Because you will hit a point that when you do need to bring a co-founder in. But that point in the entrepreneur founder journey has shifted quite a lot mm-hmm. to the future. I don't know if that answers your question.
It did. And I'm going to add something to it. I am seeing more and more platforms being developed with AI for the use of AI. So don't be concerned or scared if you are less technical, because I think people are starting to focus on the shifts in the world of work and the future of work. And the super technical people are building platforms so that you can engage with the benefits of AI. Low code, no code has been a thing for a while now. But I think it takes business acumen more than technical acumen to launch whatever your product is, whether it's a hard product or a service. I think that the portals and the tools are going to be out there for you to plug in easily. So I know there's a lot of people who still feel like AI is this really complex thing. And I think more and more I'm seeing a lot of simplifications being packaged and delivered to people.
So I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do you think that the population that is afraid of AI are, or hesitant to use, maybe is
hesitant
a better way to
fine.
Put it,
yeah.
are they hesitant to use AI because they think that their skills may no longer be needed? Or why do you think they are hesitant? Is it security?
It's all the things. But I think the real reason is just it's something that they're... When we all got smartphones, there are boundaries with what you can do with a smartphone. And of course, it's grown tremendously in the last 20 years. But you know what it does for you. And AI is, in my opinion, no, it's not my opinion, I'm right, is so broad. I think that breadth of what you can do with AI overwhelms people, because it's not just that the iPhone, smartphones were new technology and we all jumped on board and learned it. Because with AI, you've got to decide what you want to do. And I think that's harder for people to narrow in on what they want to do that is enabled by AI. And that's a little overwhelming. And it's changing so rapidly. So people who are not, don't have a propensity for jumping in and rolling up their sleeves with more technical things, all they see is the rapid shifts that are occurring. And that makes them kind of stay away from it because they think they could never keep up. That's my opinion.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can explore more of this later or the next time I see you, which will be tomorrow at the AI Infra Summit.
A big
meetup. We topped 750 invitations this, no, registrations this morning. So it's going to be a wonderful event over at the Microsoft campus.
I'm looking forward to that one,
yeah,
for sure. First time
going
to be here.
Event.
I'm excited.
Ignite GTM does a remarkable job pulling together communities, much like this KPCR community. So Igor Kresna, thank you. I'm getting better and better at that. Thank you for being here today. It has been wonderful to spend time with you on Reset with Tanya here on KPCR LP 92.9 FM in sunny blue sky Los Gatos.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure and love the conversation.
So
looking forward to the next one.
We can do it again. All right. Everyone, have a wonderful day, and we will see you next Thursday at 11 a.m. Take care, everyone. Thanks for joining us on Reset. Remember, transformation is a journey, not a destination. So until next time, keep exploring what's possible. I'm Tanya Long, and this is Home. This is Reset.